This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
What do you do if one trade war is not enough? Why, you threaten to start a second one, of course. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today, the 31st of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Just so as we're all clear, the trade wars in question are the one with China, of course, which has been discussed ad infinitum here and elsewhere. The new one, the president threatened last night with Mexico, 5% tariffs to start with, effective in something like a week and a half. And then just as a bonus, let's remember he likes to talk, the president does, about putting tariffs on cars, too. So that is where we start today. Kate Davidson is with The Wall Street Journal. Samaya Keynes is at The Economist. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai. Hi.
Kate, let me start with you and ask you about the, well, it appears to me anyway, to be the curious commingling of policy here, trade and tariffs with immigration, because that's what the president is interested in having the Mexicans stop as a result of these tariffs. Discuss.
Yeah, well, so this is something, Kai, that is making markets extremely nervous. I mean, they were already freaking out about tariffs. And I think, as I saw one analyst put it, this is just throwing gas on the fire. So it, you know, sets this concerning precedent, I think, that leaves investors wondering how else the tariffs could possibly be used, you know, by using this trade policy tool to enforce, you know, policy outside of trade. So, you know, obviously more broadly, they have these concerns about the knock-on effects for the U.S. economy. But I think it's the uncertainty piece of that that's the problem.
Right. Samaya, let me ask you this. If you are a potential trading partner of the United States, whether it's Japan or, you know, the Chinese, because they're certainly watching this and we do trade with them, and the president does this even as he has just lifted steel and aluminum tariffs, and oh, by the way, there's the new USMCA, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Free Trade Agreement that he wants to get signed on the Hill, he does this, what are you thinking?
I'm not thinking great thoughts, to be honest. So, you know, clearly if Mexico thought it had a deal with the U.S., and then, you know, a deal which in theory was supposed to stop the two sides from applying tariffs, and then Trump goes ahead and threatens tariffs anyway, then what's the value of that deal? And if you're a trading partner, what's the point of making a concession to get a deal if the Americans are just going to turn around after 10 minutes and say, oh, no, sorry, actually, we want more concessions from you?
Well, Kate, what is the point then, do you think? I mean, what do you do if you're trying to negotiate trade with not the American government, right? Because there is an apparatus set up to do this in a coherent manner. But according to reports today, many in the White House were not even aware this was coming.
Oh, Kai, I don't know how to answer that question.
Okay.
But I mean, I know we heard that that the trade rep Lighthizer was not happy.
Right.
This is something apparently that the president had talked about wanting to do for a long time, but people had always talked him out of it. You know, Lighthizer has a good relationship with Nancy Pelosi. He'd apparently been making progress behind the scenes in advancing the deal. And so, you know, I think that it sounds like he's pretty frustrated. And someone else pointed out, you know, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin had been working with Lighthizer. Someone pointed out he has not been on TV in quite a while, but we are hearing from Peter Navarro.
Wow.
You know, he's more of a trade hardliner. So I think that's, you know, maybe another influential voice, and it shows sometimes how the shifting influence inside the White House is really important.
Yeah. You know, first of all, not knowing the answer to a trade question with this White House, I think is perfectly acceptable, right? We should just get that on the table. But also, since you mentioned Peter Navarro, Samaya, let me ask you this. Navarro went on TV today, said some things that are simply not true about tariffs. He said the Chinese are going to pay and the Mexicans are going to pay. I guess the question is, do you think he's gaslighting the American public, or does he genuinely not know what he's talking about?
Oh, Yeah. I mean, you know, it's possible that Peter Navarro has not read the latest academic papers on the immediate impact of the steel tariffs, the China tariffs, the washing machines tariffs, the solar panels tariffs. Yeah. All the evidence out there does suggest that at least in the short run, it is the importers who are paying the cost of the tariff, i.e. not China, not Mexico. Now, it is possible that over long, long periods of time, some of that adjusts. Maybe the Chinese or the Mexicans suck up more of the tariff. But if you're thinking about the immediate hit, these 5% tariffs, maybe going up to 25%, it really is Americans. And, you know, of course, lots of the trade going on across the Mexican border is essentially between companies that are very strongly, very closely related to each other. Right. So actually, you might have, you know, one American company that is both the importer and the exporter. So really, then you're just taxing an American company.
Right. And we're going to get to actually cars here in a minute with Kimberly Adams, in which that is very much the case. Kate, let me ask you a question about the politics of the American economy. The president's approval ratings have been virtually since the day he was elected, something around 40%. And near historic lows. His strongest asset heading into the 2020 campaign is the economy, and yet he keeps on stepping on it. Why?
Oh, I don't.
Is that another
I'm going to say
All
again,
right,
Kai.
Okay, all right,
I don't
okay,
know.
That's
no,
acceptable.
But let me say, I did see, you know, our fellow rapper, Catherine Rimpel,
yes.
You know, had a column on this today that you tweeted and saying, yeah, why is he doing this? I mean, we saw in 2018 was a big year for growth. You know, it seemed that the tax cuts were kicking in. Businesses had a lot of confidence. They were investing. With all of the kind of scandals that seem to be surrounding this White House, that was definitely a bright spot. And this is undermining it. Now, there is some speculation. Is this part of a bigger 2020 strategy?
Yeah.
Is this a short-term plan to make gains in an important, area of the ongoing trade negotiations or in the trade space? Or is this just like part of, you know, ratcheting up tensions around national security ahead of the 2020 election? It's tough to say.
Sumaya, it has to be said here, and actually you have to do it in about 30 seconds because that's all the time we have. But it has to be said, for a year and a half of trade unrest with this president, the economy is still doing quite well. We just got revised first quarter GDP this week. It's 3.something%.
Yeah, I think that has been one of the puzzles going in. Why hasn't this, you know, shown up more within the U.S. economy? I think part of the reason for that is actually the tariffs came on fairly gradually. I think when they were first announced, there was this big hoo-ha, and then it took a while for them to come in. The ones on China are ramping up in a fairly significant way. This Mexico escalation would be a big one. And I think, you know, we would see, as a result of a 25% tariff on all imports coming in from Mexico, some effect. And that would be concentrated in places like Texas that are much more reliant on Mexico.
Right. Sumaya Keynes at The Economist and Kate Davidson at The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a nice weekend. Enjoy your Friday. Wall Street on this last Friday of May, by the way. It was lousy. Bad day, bad week, bad month. Details, numbers, you know the drill. You know who's really not happy about possibly, who knows, maybe new tariffs on each and every single thing we import from Mexico, as I was alluding to with Sumaya Keynes? Car companies. That's who. The big automakers in this country have built their entire supply chain around free trade with Mexico. And so analysts and a whole lot of industry people in Detroit are scrambling to unpack just how a 5 or maybe, if it goes this far, a 25% tariff would affect that system. And as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, the numbers do start adding up pretty quick.
As you may have heard us say, once or twice, a tariff is a tax. And an import tax is one thing when you're talking about a single item like an avocado, but a car has thousands of different parts. And thanks in part to NAFTA,
Mexico is by far the largest manufacturer of auto parts that we source from here in the United States.
Garrett Nelson is a senior equity analyst with CFRA. He says the U.S. imported about $59 billion in auto parts from Mexico last year.
We estimate if the full 25% tariff were to be enforced, that would increase the cost of the average automobile by anywhere from $1,000 to $1,500.
That's because manufacturing a car is a cross-border event. Torsten Slok is chief economist at Deutsche Bank Securities.
some parts of a car's content is initially produced in the U.S., then is transported to be assembled in Mexico, then it comes back to the U.S. when more value is added.
Slock says that cross-border dance can happen 7 to 8 times before a car rolls off the lot. And if Mexico retaliates, there could be new taxes in both directions.
I mean, that could be a cascading effect, a cumulative effect of the tariff.
Christine McDaniel is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Institute.
But it's also really hard to imagine that this tariff would actually go into place just because of the heavy reliance that U.S. businesses have on Mexico and vice versa.
In other words, President Trump might have a few incentives to rethink his tariffs. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Elsewhere in car-related news today, ethanol, the Environmental Protection Agency, says it's going to lift the summertime ban that's been in place on the sale of gasoline mixed with 15% ethanol. Farmers, whence corn and so the ethanol comes, are happy. Environmentalists and gasoline refiners ain't. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that one.
The EPA had restricted sales of this gas, known as E15, because it causes smog in warm weather. But now the EPA says retailers can sell it year-round. Josh Price is a senior analyst at Height Capital Markets. He says this is President Trump fulfilling his promise to help farmers who grow corn for ethanol.
A lot of these farmers are being hurt by his trade policies. So this is, you know, kind of a glimmer of hope that he's trying to provide some corn growers in those Midwestern states.
The EPA says this isn't a political move. The agency describes it as a compromise. But refiners who have to mix ethanol into their gasoline, they're not happy. Derek Morgan with the refiners trade group American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers says smaller refiners will struggle this summer.
Because those refineries don't have easy access to ethanol and they have to buy it from others.
Those refiners may not have to worry. Morgan says his group will file a lawsuit to stop summertime sales of E15. Environmentalists aren't happy either. Benjamin Leard of Resources for the Future says more ethanol could mean shrinking forests.
Some landowners could shift their range or their forest into cropland to produce more ethanol, and then that would have potential impacts on overall greenhouse gas emissions.
There won't be a huge impact at first. One ethanol advocacy group estimates that sales will increase by around 2% over the next 5 years. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Among the known unknowns of the president's threatened tariffs on Mexico is what they are going to mean for the prospects of the recently signed but not yet ratified replacement for the North American Free Trade Agreement. Of the many parts of this economy that the USMCA, as it's officially known, is going to affect, farming and agriculture is a biggie. So we have done what we do when we need an on-the-ground farming and agriculture source. We've called apple and a hops farmer Patrick Smith up in Washington State, whose biggest export market, oh, by the way, is Mexico. Hey, Patrick, it's Kai. How are you?
Good, Kai. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for taking the time. Sorry we keep calling you, trying to figure out what the hell's going on in this economy.
Oh, no, it's all right. Actually, when I woke up this morning and saw the news, I thought, you know what? Today kind of feels like a day that I'm going to hear from Kai. kind of half expected it.
There we go. All right. So look, we went back and checked. We had you on in January talking mostly about China tariffs, and you were not wild about things. This news today, though, with more tariffs coming on Mexico and what it might mean for the new NAFTA, the USMCA, given how much of your apple crop you send to Mexico, how you feeling?
Yeah, I mean, we had hope that things were beginning to turn around when the U.S. dropped the steel tariffs and Mexico responded by dropping their tariffs on U.S. apples and other goods, but there was good progress toward ratification of USMCA, but this action seems to threaten final approval of that deal. And so now it kind of feels like here we go again. And I don't really understand the logic behind this new strategy.
Well, I'm not sure anybody outside the immigration community in the White House does, but let me ask you a slightly different question, and it goes like this. As we've talked about before, you cannot plan your apple crop, right? I mean, trees are going to grow apples and they're going to be ready. And in fact, you know, we talked like a year ago and apparently you're growing more apples than ever. So what do you do when trade policy, in essence, right? That's what this is. Changes at the drop of a hat.
Yeah, I mean, it makes it really hard to plan and to make investments in the future. Exports of U.S. apples are down about 30% year over year after a number of years of solid growth. And so that just backs up a lot of the product into the U.S. market. And yeah, it throws a lot of uncertainty into the mix, and farming's already an uncertain business. And so adding uncertainty on top of it makes people pretty nervous.
Let me take a real quick turn to immigration because, you know, as we talked about when I was up there a couple of four years ago, you count on immigrant labor to do a lot of your harvesting. You do it the right way. You do the visas and all of that stuff. But it's got to be hitting you there, too.
Absolutely. I mean, this brings together trade and immigration policy, which to farmers in our region is probably the two most impactful policy arenas. And due in large part to exports being down, as I mentioned earlier, prices for our goods aren't keeping up with the significant increase in labor costs that we've incurred over the last few years to just attract and retain the farm workers that we do have. And a workable immigration policy that allows safe and legal labor to flow back and forth between the U.S. and Mexico is critical to our ability to grow abundant, safe, and healthy food for American consumers.
When is apple harvest? I should know this, talking to an apple farmer, but I don't. When's the harvest and then what happens?
Harvest will start usually right around the middle of August, and that'll run into November, typically up here in Washington. And so, yeah, I mean, what happens? Well, I mean, we're going to do our best with the labor that we have. Many growers are utilizing the H-2A visa program now, and including us. And so we're pretty confident that we have the labor that we need right now to harvest the crop this fall. But that program needs reform and needs to come in the form of a comprehensive immigration bill.
Patrick Smith, he and his family run Loftus Ranches up in Yakima, Washington, just because I got to get the plug in here every time. They grow hops, too. Good beer up there. I've had it. Patrick, thanks
That's
a lot.
That's right. That's right.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you, Kai. Talk
Bye-bye.
To you soon.
Coming up.
The swimming pool, the spa, the club rooms. There's a co-work space.
Remember condos, anybody? First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, it had to be the Wawa's, right? I've decided that's what I'm going with, by the way, Wawa's. Enough of this bent trombone thing. Dow Industrials, apologies to all trombonists out there. Dow Industrials off 354 points, 1.4%, 24,815 on this Friday. The NASDAQ down 114 points, 1.5%, 7,453. The S&P 500 dipped 36 points, 1.3%, 27,052. For the week, the Dow off 3%, the NASDAQ down 2.4%, the S&P 500 dropped 2.6% for the week. So, cars, talked about them, right? Ford down 2.2% today. GM gave up 4.2%. Mazda assembles cars in Mexico for the U.S. market, down 7.1%. Today of Fiat, Chrysler, Honda, and Toyota down, and more down. I'm going to give you bonds here just because we've been talking about them all week. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note, 2.13%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hey, everybody, it's Kai Rizdahl. You got to listen to the latest Make Me Smart, the show where we connect the dots on all things tech, economics, and culture. The White House basically banned U.S. companies from doing business with Huawei, the Chinese tech giant. That has not only deepened the trade war, it has dropped a digital iron curtain between the U.S. and China. Some even say we're in a new tech Cold War.
It is pretty serious. I think this is one of China's largest and most successful companies, and the fact that the U.S. has really taken a direct hit at it, has just escalated the tension we have with China significantly.
Make Me Smart. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Walt Disney Company's latest money printing factory opened today. The long-awaited Star Wars attraction Galaxy's Edge takes up 14 acres of Disneyland. You can build and buy your own droid there for $99, drink a glass of blue milk at a cantina full of space smugglers and bounty hunters, and otherwise spend a whole lot of real money in a pretend world. Marketplace's Mario Segarra has that one.
When you walk into Galaxy's Edge, you're supposed to imagine that you've landed on this fictional planet called Batuu. And Disney did some elaborate world building here. There's a full-sized replica of the Millennium Falcon. Chewbacca is wandering around. And you can build your own lightsaber for $200. Dirk Libby, a writer for CinemaBlend, did that.
As opposed to the fairly simple plastic things that you've been able to buy forever, this is a pretty hefty hilt. It makes you feel like you are really, you know, joining the Jedi.
Galaxy's Edge has one ride at the moment and another in the works. But Don Munsell at the travel website mousesavers.com says the rides aren't really the point.
The land is the ride, you know. The experience of being there is supposed to be a lot of the enjoyment factor.
World building is part of Disney's DNA, but Galaxy's Edge amps it up with things like a smartphone app that lets you go on a secret mission for the Resistance. Seth Kuberski, who wrote the unofficial guide to Disneyland, says Galaxy's Edge is a way for Disney to compete with the Harry Potter-themed worlds at Universal theme parks. They showed that you can build an entire land around just one intellectual property.
And not only can you do it, but it will make fans flock from all over the world and spend a lot of money on special merchandise and beverages that they can't get anywhere else.
On Planet Batuu, you've got 4 hours to buy your lightsabers and droids. After that, a stormtrooper will escort you out. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Back before the housing market went south, 12, I guess 13 years ago now, there was a thing in real estate that was quite the thing. Back in the early 2000s, builders couldn't build new condos fast enough. And apartment building after apartment building was booting out longtime renters to go condo, looking for young buyers trying to get a step up on the housing ladder. You fast forward to today, and given that condos are typically much less expensive than single-family homes, and that single-family homes are out of reach for so many would-be homeowners, you'd think condos would be having a moment. Not really. We sent Marketplace's Amy Scott to find out why.
A concrete mixing truck has just arrived at a massive construction site in Denver's Sunnyside neighborhood. Workers guide the concrete into a huge bucket, which is hoisted by crane to the second floor, or what will become the second floor, of an 8-story building. This is the future Zia Sunnyside, a city block's worth of apartments, condos, and retail space with a $116 million price tag.
There's a rooftop sky lounge on the 8th floor that has 360-degree views of the Front Range in downtown Denver.
Tim Walsh is CEO of Confluence Companies, the developer and property manager. There will be an automated package locker, a yoga studio,
the swimming pool, the spa, the club rooms. There's a co-work space.
Sounds pretty posh, and it is. The average price for a condo is $440,000. But 20% of the units are designed to be affordable for working-class Denverites. $185,000 for a one-bedroom, $232,000 for a two-bedroom. Given the demand for more affordable housing, you'd think there'd be a lot of projects like this.
Historically, newly built condos have been a source of entry-level housing.
Robert Dietz is chief economist of the National Association of Home Builders. He says there aren't a lot of Zia Sunnysides going up. Nationally, builders added only 24,000 new condo units over the past year, compared to 60,000 to 70,000 a decade ago. And sales of existing condos have been falling for months.
On the new construction side, this is just one part of the industry that never really recovered after the Great Recession.
A big reason, Dietz says, is that condos are more expensive and complicated to build than apartments. Materials have to meet higher standards, financing is harder to get, and insurance costs are higher because of the risk of lawsuits over construction defects. Builders can make more money with apartments.
Right now, about 96% of multifamily construction is built for rent. That compares to about an 80% historic share.
Plus, condos have an image problem. Allison Arieff is with the urban policy think tank Spur in San Francisco.
Part of the reason for lack of demand for condos is that perception that, well, people don't really want this or a family can't live in it.
Buyers worry their investment won't pay off. More of them have been turning to townhouses, still more affordable than single-family homes, but they have that coveted front door. But realtors say condos could get a boost from two types of buyers.
Yeah, I call it my bookends.
Denver broker Allie Carlson says at one end of the shelf are the young professionals wanting a foothold in the market.
And on the flip side, there's a lot of people that have become recent empty nesters. They're interested in the urban lifestyle downtown.
People like her client, Charles Goldberg.
This is our apartment, 4D. It's a loft space.
With exposed brick and enormous wood beams, the building used to be a seed warehouse. Charles and his wife Bonnie, both retired lawyers, recently sold their four-bedroom farmhouse on Long Island in New York and bought this loft in downtown Denver to be closer to their daughter.
We wanted a place with public transportation. We wanted a place which is walkable. The other advantage that Denver has from our perspective is culture.
You heard it. A New Yorker says we have culture. Another plus of condo living, somebody else shovels the snow. In Denver, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today from the White House this afternoon. This item, President Trump is going to be giving the Presidential Medal of Freedom to Arthur Laffer next month. Arthur Laffer, perhaps best known for the Laffer curve and the not universally subscribed to theory, shall we say, known as supply-side economics. He is also an author, Arthur Laffer is, most recently of a book titled Trumponomics, of which the subject of that book said, an incredible book on my economic policies. Anyway, Laffer's getting the country's highest civilian award next month. All right, we're out of here. The Dow off 354 points today, 1.4%. The NASDAQ off 114, 1.5%. The S&P 500 dipped 36 points, about 1.3%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We are back on Monday, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.